I do not know a day I did not love you. I can't remember love not being there. The planting when the harvest when the sun danced in your hair. I do not know a day I did not need you, for sharing every moment that I spent. I needed you before I ever knew what needing someone meant.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, July 17th, 2016. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
Peter and I got a chance to go over to the Mitzi Newhouse over at Lincoln Center and see a play called Oslo. So, Peter, why don't you get us started on Oslo?
Sure. I think that seldom has a complicated play been so entertaining. That's the special factor here, because we are talking about politics. And if you're a political junkie, you may know the story of the Oslo Accords back in 1993, when indeed a Norwegian man, whose last name we'll say is Rod Larsen, there is a slash through the O, and I don't know how that's pronounced, but he decided that he might be able to do something to help the Palestinian Liberation Organization and Israel come to terms and work out something. And, you know, it's interesting that a Norwegian and Israel and Palestine should essentially take their lead from a Chinese philosopher who said the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, because that's what they're doing. They're not trying to fix everything. Let's just see if we can make a few things happen here, not totality, but gradually, and see if that works out. Now, the way J.T. Rogers, the playwright, has done this is establish the fact that there is going to be essentially a war zone and essentially a peace zone. And when you've heard the expression divide and conquer. Well, he gives it a new meaning, because he'll make the conference room the place for all business and the room immediately outside it as the place for no business. Out here, we'll share our meals, we'll tell of our families, he says. So everyone must make nice when they break for tea, even if they had no sympathy for what was just said inside. So you hear things like, a rabbi and a Buddhist priest are on an airplane. You may know that joke. It's not a new one, but everybody's trying to make nice. And it isn't easy, because, for example, when the Israeli says he hasn't been home in a while, the Palestinian says, I haven't been home since 1967, meaning that since the Six-Day War back in 1967, when Israel won that part of the territory, that he feels that that is still a part that should be Palestinian. The thing is, much like 1776, what happens here is that the people are shown to be very human. Nobody's above criticizing people on a personal level. For example, Warren Christopher, who was then Secretary of State, is described as a cold fish, you know, that type of thing. So people really let their hair down. But there's no question that it can get explosive at times, even in that outer room. The irony is we don't get into the room where it happens, if you'll pardon the expression, because he keeps us outside. inside. We don't really know what goes on. And this is a three-act play. It is 3 hours long as well. And much of it seems to be the same material going over and over and over again, but that's what happens in these things. New people come in, new people make demands. A simple word that is changed from one to another makes such a difference, much like the Declaration of Independence in 1776. But because the people are so willing to let their hair down and be themselves, that's where it gets so entertaining. And for those of us who are political junkies, yes, we'll find it a bit easier than those who are not, let's say, the opposite of political junkies, I guess, are political non-users. I don't know. But anyway, those who do not follow politics tremendously well, I don't believe you're going to get lost. I may be overstating the case, but I don't think so. The acting, tremendous. Jefferson Mays is the one who's trying to make peace. Jennifer Ely as his wife, trying to make peace as well. Terrific. Everybody is really quite wonderful, and certainly you are going to be impressed by the level of acting, and it's a Bartlett Chair show, and he usually delivers the goods, and this time he's done it as well. So don't be afraid of it if you think it's going to be terribly complicated. People who didn't like Democracy or Copenhagen will find this one far more welcoming, so give it a try. And, you know, I know theater tickets are expensive, but at least this is one with two intermissions. So if you don't like it, you have two opportunities to leave. I hope that doesn't happen.
Peter and I saw it on the same night. I was a few rows away from Peter, and I have to support everything that Peter's saying. I was all cards on the table here. I was really regretting my choice of picking a three-hour show that had an 8 o'clock start, and I had a very early start that day at 5 a.m. And so I thought for sure I was going to be exhausted. I loved this show. I was excited at 11:15 p.m. when I walked out of the theater, and I just wanted to tell everybody to get tickets to it. Unfortunately, I think this is a really hard ticket to get. I was looking at tickets, and nearly impossible to get. It's not a great, a large theater, the New House. How many seats do you think the New House is? 500 or so?
Well, it's got to be under 500 to be an off-Broadway venue.
Just under 500. And they have their subscribers, and it's a very hot show. It's very popular. So we were talking just before we started recording that maybe there'll be a transfer for this so that more people can get a chance to see it. I encourage everybody to see it.
Well, what they could do is just transfer it upstairs to the Beaumont, because there's nothing scheduled there, is there?
I don't think so.
I think it might be too big. The Beaumont might be too big for this. What do you think, Peter?
Yes, I think it should be in a small house. If it does transfer, I think it should go the route of Eclipse. Not that that was commercially successful, but I'd go to the Golden because we know that the Helen Hayes is not going to be available. Yeah. And the booth has a booking as well, so we'll see what happens.
Is nothing going into the Beaumont, Michael?
Not that I know of. I mean, I don't think
anything's been announced.
I mean, they may have something, but and I don't think it's going to happen before the fall. When is Oslo scheduled to run until?
September something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, so it is I'm blown away by this production. I thought it was great. I'm encouraging everybody to see it. The cast is amazing. They do try to do as much as possible to educate you about this event before the actors ever walk on stage. There's slips in the program about it. There's a large Peter, did you get the Lincoln Center Theater Review? The full magazine has got a whole section on the timeline of Oslo inside of it. And so if this is something that you are not familiar with, this is 20, I'm looking at it now, 24 pages of information on Oslo, the actual events and things like that, to put it in context, so that you can follow this if you feel as though that you're going to walk in. But I think that they do a really good job at I mean, I was aware of Oslo and aware of the players involved with it, but didn't really know the details of it. And I followed it really well. And they, what, Peter, do you think they do that very opening bit where they break the fourth wall and hand the playbill to somebody in the audience? Did you see that?
Yeah. They certainly do break the fourth wall. And this play could be said to have attention deficit disorder because I'm telling you, at the very beginning, it goes all over the place. Things happen more quickly. A scene deals with 9 months in very short order, and then suddenly you're somewhere else, and people enter without anybody saying hello. I mean, that's very smart of J.T. Rogers, rather than saying, ah, Mr. So-and-so, welcome. You know, they just show up, and suddenly you're in the middle of it. So there's a lot of that going on, too. So think about it. If there were, Mr. So-and-so, welcome, then it would be 3 hours and 15 minutes long. So bless J.T. Rogers for knowing that he doesn't need to be that realistic. He rarely is when he has to do stage business. But you do feel like he's being very realistic when he deals with the dialogue. You know, Lee Blessing did a play called A Walk in the Woods, and it was a Soviet and American coming to terms with this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, while watching it, I thought to myself, gee, I mean, like, it takes a lot on to say, I think I know what happened in that meeting. And I didn't get the feeling here with this. I really felt like the playwright not only had done his homework, but really had inside information. I'm not saying he did, but I felt that way. While I didn't feel that Lee Blessing had inside information, that I felt I was hearing Lee Blessing, here I felt like I was really hearing the characters, and that's a profound difference.
There's a lot of exposition in the show to help the audience along, and normally I really dislike exposition, but it worked for me. I appreciated what they said, and they didn't do it too much, and they didn't treat us like idiots. Each one of the characters, you know, might have stepped out of their character and talked directly to the audience for a few seconds here and there to reestablish something that was happening that might have been a little bit complexer, not clearly evident to those who don't know the story inside and out. Just amazing. Jefferson Mays, Jennifer Ely, the whole cast were just really, really good. I hope that this transfers, and I hope that more people get to see it. And that it just doesn't have, you know, a life in London and in Los Angeles and Chicago, that it makes its way to other places. And
well, again, not having seen it, I think that it seems to me like it would make a lot of sense to consider just putting it in the Beaumont, because, you know, they own it. So they're all of those costs evaporate. A, B, if you feel the Beaumont is too big, you could close the balcony, and just use, you know, and it would still be Tony eligible. And then if it goes really well, then you could open the balcony. And I just think that they probably thought of it already. So I'm sure I'm not giving Andre Bishop any ideas here, but it sounds like that might be a possible way to go.
Let me add this, too, that you may say to yourself, but it didn't hold. And the play acknowledges that the peace treaty didn't quite work out. And at the end, there is an epilogue where everybody just stands and looks at us, nicely positioned, and tells us what happens to each of the people and what happened to the peace accord. And this is almost analogous to 1776, where you you know the ending before you go in. But I remember so vividly when this happened in real life, when Oslo really happened, that I had written in Theater Week magazine, well, that line in Shirley Valentine is now obsolete, because Shirley Valentine had a line saying, I think that marriage is like the Middle East. There's no solution. And I wrote at the time, but now we have a solution. I'm afraid the Shirley Valentine line turned out to be continually relevant, which I'm sorry to say, but yes, they do acknowledge the fact that this didn't work out as delightfully as it could have.
And the other part that I want to mention before we move on is that I felt that they really used the projections very well. They didn't overuse them, and
that's right.
The projections are getting better and better on Broadway with each show that I see, and they're not using it to dazzle the audience. They're really using it to move the story forward and explain. And the projections used in Oslo were so subtle and so wonderful. Bravo to everybody involved there. I was talking with Matt Tamanini on the Today on Broadway broadcast on Thursday after, or Friday after I saw Oslo, and I said a show like this shows us that what are these seemingly impossible set of circumstances may have solutions, and in this, you know, last couple of weeks of tragedy that we think that how in the world are we ever going to solve these issues? Theater shows us once again that these things can be solved and that in real life we have solved them before.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point.
So let's move forward to solving all the other problems at 54 Below, because Michael saw Broadway originals and we're all jealous, aren't we, Michael?
Well, it was a wonderful show, one of Scott Siegel's series, Broadway originals, featuring performers who originated roles either in the first productions of shows or the first or a subsequent revival. And of course, with the March of Time being what it is, we have more of the latter than the former than I guess maybe there used to be. But also, of course, there are newer shows represented. So this was a wonderful mix of people. Josh Grisetti opened the show with a song called Whatever from It Should Have Been You, which really was delightful. I haven't listened to that since I saw the show, and I remember how much I enjoyed it. And that, as I'm sure we discussed at the time, that was a show that it seemed to me everyone I knew
absolutely
really enjoyed it.
You bet.
Not one person I spoke to didn't like
it.
That's
exactly right.
It just was, for whatever reason, it wasn't commercial. It was a gentle show, not a big razzmatazz show. And maybe, I don't know, maybe the subject matter. I hope that show has a life. And
just got done in St. Louis.
Oh, great. Wonderful.
Yeah, at Stages, a very fine theater out in St. Louis. So yes, I think we will hear more from it.
Wonderful. Then this is not in any order, but Daniel Reichard sang Cry For Me from Jersey Boys, and making the argument that that show kind of helped to legitimize the jukebox musical, or at least the bio musical. Martin Vidnovic sang. There were several possibilities for him because he really was very big on Broadway in the late 70s and early 80s, doing leads in revivals of shows. But what he chose to sing was the beautiful There But For You Go I from Brigadoon. And boy, does he still have his voice.
Oh, nice. Good.
Yeah. Bob Stillman sang a song from Grey Gardens. I don't have the title. It's the song where Big Edie's accompanist and cohort finally decides to – he has to kind of separate from her. And that was great. But then he – this is amazing. He sang a cut song from Legs Diamond. Bob Stillman originally was in Legs Diamond playing the main character's brother, Peter Allen's brother. And first, apparently, this song was cut, and then the role was cut completely. And also cut from that production was Christine Andreas. There was a lot of mayhem, apparently, during rehearsals for Legs Diamond, which did not turn out very well at all, although it has some wonderful songs in it. Anyway, this song that Bob Stillman sang that was cut from Legs Diamond, he introduced it and saying how lovely it was. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, whatever. It was a beautiful, beautiful song. And I said to him afterwards, I said, Bob, that song is better than most of the songs that made it into the show. He said, yeah, I know. I'm going to have to ask him if I don't know. I mean, it would be wonderful if someone could record it. I don't think anyone has, and it'd be nice to get the sheet music. So I'm really going to have to find out about that. Walter Willison did two songs from 2x2. I Do Not Know a Day I Did Not Love You, which is his signature song, which he introduced, and which is very popular. And he told an anecdote about Tony Bennett recording it, how much Tony Bennett loved the song. And then another song, a very different, much more angry song from Act One, I believe, of 2x2 called Something's Somewhere. So he did those two, did a beautiful job. Shelley Birch sang Unusual Way from Nine. And it was lovely to see her again and hear her again. And Ken Jennings, who I really have not seen on stage in many years, did two numbers, Snuff That Girl from You're in Town, and of course Not While I'm Around from Sweeney Todd. And that really brought me back, because I was at the second performance of Sweeney Todd, and to hear him sing that again was really very, very special.
Michael, I'm curious, when you say second performance, do you mean second performance or second preview?
Second performance after the opening.
Okay, go on.
Yeah. No, because I know that was those previews
sure.
were.
That's why. So
it was a wonderful evening. Beth Fowler had been announced, but she apparently took ill, so she couldn't perform. And Eddie Corbett had been on the list at one point, but he wasn't there, so that was disappointing. If he had been there, I suppose he and Ken Jennings could have done a duet of Not While I'm Around, because Eddie played Tobias in the revival at Circle in the Square years ago. So anyway, it was a great evening. And Scott has coming up, I think the 25th, a Broadway Unplugged at Town Hall, which, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, features Broadway performers singing with no amplification whatsoever, which you hardly ever, ever, ever get to hear anymore. So check that out. Double check the date. And it's usually tickets for the Town Hall shows are gettable because it's a pretty large venue. And if you're not aware of this series, this Broadway series that Scott does at Town Hall and elsewhere, including 54 Below, you really should check it out.
I want to say that you're mentioning being at the second performance ever of Sweeney Todd. I was at one of the very first performances in the New Haven tryout of 2x2. And I was sitting next to Arthur Miller, ironically enough, because his sister, Joan Copeland, was in the show playing the wife of Noah. To Danny Kaye. Now, of course, this became a very troubled production as time went on, because Danny Kaye lost interest in it. Then he hurt himself and he started improvising like crazy. Even, again, Noah in the Ark time, remember, even making references to No, No, Nanette. And it really became a shambles, and he paid a price for that because he didn't get a Tony nomination. The only person who did get a Tony nomination was Walter Willison, who, according to a letter in the Times, when somebody wrote in to complain, never varied his performance while everybody else succumbed to Danny Kaye's improv. They started laughing, you know, that type of thing. Walter Willison wouldn't give in, but here's my point. We're in New Haven and we're ready for the opening number. There's such excitement in the house because this is the new Richard Rodgers musical. Okay, fine. The first song at that point in time, which was replaced eventually, was called Everything That's Gonna Be Has Been. And there's Noah talking about the fact that nothing new has ever happened. And, you know, for those of us who remember that opening songs in Rodgers musicals include everything from Oh, What a Beautiful Morning to The Sound of Music, well, this one wasn't very exciting. The second song in the show was called Put Him Away, because everybody, all of Noah's family thought that he was crazy for talking about building an ark and bringing animals on it. And it was a decent enough song. It wasn't bad. I still like it. It's on the cast album. It stayed in. But, you know, for those of us who are used to second songs of Rodgers and Hammerstein shows being something like When I Marry Mr. Snow or Maria, again, you know, it just didn't pack the punch. And then Walter Willison came on and he sang this Somebody Somewhere song, in which he talks about God. There must be something somewhere that you like. Mm-hmm. Are you going to destroy everything? Are you? What's going on with you? And I'm telling you, that song was so terrific and so galvanizing. And that's when the audience completely bought into the show, because suddenly we heard something tremendously exciting by somebody who we hadn't known before. And that might very well have been when Danny Kaye started losing interest in 2x2, because he didn't get the song that really tore down the house at that point in time.
Well, you may not know this, or you may, but this makes it even more interesting. When Walter introduced that song the other night, he said originally it was Danny Kaye's song.
Oh!
It was Danny Kaye's song in a very different form. It was the same melody, but in a much more gentle, I think it's in 3/4, and it was a much more gentle waltz kind of thing. And then they took it away. Yes, they took it away from him and completely reconceived it and gave it to Walter. So you can imagine that only amplifies what you just said.
Sure. Wow.
Yep.
So we had Walter on the show here, I think last year, when 54 Below did the Grand Hotel reunion. Was it Grand Hotel Reunion, or it was a concert
Perfect.
For Grand Hotel?
Yeah, absolutely.
And Walter and I have talked at length, personally, privately, about the Danny Kaye antics in 2x2. I think there should be a book. I think somebody should write a book.
Well, is it Martin Gottfried who wrote about Danny Kaye? I think it was a book called Nobody's Fool. And he certainly at least gives a good deal of the chapter and quotes Walter in it as well. So at least there's a solid chapter that's very well written in a book called Nobody's Fool. So take a look for that.
And Scott Siegel continues to hit them out of the park. He is more consistent than Derek Jeter in his heyday. So
I thoroughly agree. Scott Siegel has been such an invaluable resource in this town, getting people together who are either looking for nostalgia and rediscovering old songs, or for those young people who want to know what the golden age of Broadway was like. It's so exciting to be in Town Hall when he does those shows, and his patter is really very amusing as well. So here's to you, Scott Siegel, for doing what you do.
And also, as you've implied, the mix of people, to have the honored veterans like Ken Jennings and Walter and Martin Vidnovic on stage with Josh Grizzetti and Daniel Reichardt is really wonderful. And by the way, I double checked, and yes, July 25th, Broadway Unplugged Town Hall. Be there.
Yeah, we should people should follow Scott Siegel on social media as much as they follow Jennifer Ashley Tepper. You know, those are the two people to keep your finger on the pulse of what is the thing you should be doing. So, Peter, you got up to the Goodspeed Opera House to see another Broadway original, if I can, Bye Bye Birdie. So tell us about Bye Bye Birdie.
Well, what was the most compelling thing to me was the ad campaign on Bye Bye Birdie, because there's the line that you see in the ad saying, "It's Birdie like you've never seen it before." So now you have to wonder, all right, is this one of those slogans to get people in, you know, which is what I suspected, or would this actually be a revisal of the musical? So surprisingly enough to me, it was the latter. Michael Stewart still gets the sole book credit, but if you look carefully in the press materials in the program, it says the director, Jen Thompson, had a new take. So I think she's the one who's made the changes in the structure and the book, because it doesn't start out with the scene in the Al May Lou office where Albert is really fretting over the fact that he's going to be losing Conrad Birdie, his meal ticket to the Army, that he won't be able to record for 2 years. And Rosie comes up with the idea, his secretary and his lover, come up with the idea that maybe they should do a contest of pick a name and have some arbitrary fan of Birdie's out of the 2 million in the fan club to give Birdie a last kiss. By the way, in the original production, there was this sea of, well, think about the old days when libraries had card catalogs. That's what it looked like. That's what the office looked like. And there are many pictures of that office, so you can see what I mean if you just do a little research. Here, I'm sorry to say, they had two little boxes, and they picked a name from that. I think that was a little unconvincing. But anyway, so it's Kim McAfee from Sweet Apple, Ohio. And they have trouble getting in touch with her because everybody's on the phone in Sweet Apple because Kim has just been pinned and is going steady, which, after all, is the teen equivalent of marriage to Hugo Peabody. Okay, well, in this production, they start with the Telephone Hour, that song where everybody's talking about she's in love with him, Kim, et cetera. So that's the first change, and there are a few others, some of which are for the better, I have to say. I've always thought that the put on a happy face was very strangely done, because what it simply was originally was that Albert was trying to cheer up an unhappy teenager who was miserable because Bertie was going into the army. And she says, by the time he gets out, I'll be too old for him, which, by the way, has an interesting subtext now, because now that we know more about Elvis Presley, who, of course, was the inspiration for Conrad Bertie, we now know that the king did like them young. So, I mean, that line has an extra little layer there. But anyway, it used to be that he used to sing to her, and that's not such a good idea, because we never see her again. The movie improved it by having it sing to Rosie, and that's what happens here as well. A lot of the changes from the movie are in here. I will say that the title song, which is I think terrific, is not done the way it is in the movie, with Kim buttressing the beginning and the end, but instead it's done as a production number in Sweet Apple, which was done in that 1995 TV movie. So Jen Thompson is mixed and matched and borrowed here and there. However, there's a missed opportunity here for Patricia Wilcox, who's the choreographer, because I'm telling you, the teens just sing Bye Bye Birdie and it doesn't become a production number, which it really should be. She does better on A Lot of Living to Do, and even includes the movie verse that Kim sings there. There are men of 19 or 20, older men, etc. So, again, mixing and matching. It's a very satisfying production. I do wish that she would have dropped a line that I've always think is terrible. And that is when, deep in the show, Albert's mother, who granted has been a real pain, she's overly possessive, she doesn't want him to get married, though we'll talk about that in a second, and he finally says to her, "Mama, I don't need you anymore." Well, no, that line should go, because it's not a case of you don't need your mother anymore and you send her away. Mm-hmm. That's a very bad idea. I mean, you love your mother for different reasons. It's not a case like, I don't need you, you can't do anything for anymore, therefore you're irrelevant, go home. That's not good. And I wish that she had changed that line, but she didn't. Anyway, that's still there. Now, one of the big things that happened in 1960, before our consciousness was raised, was that May, that being Albert's mother, was very critical of Rosie simply because she was Spanish. And that was a big problem for her. And she couldn't get past that at all. She made a lot of cracks about Rosie being Spanish. Some of them are still there, though there's no question that Jen Thompson has reduced them at least by half to make it a little more palatable. But that's still there. Okay, now where's the big problem here? At one point, May brings in Gloria Rasputin, somebody she has met while on her way to Sweet Apple, Ohio, who's a va-va-va-voom lady, and she wants Albert to get involved with her so that she will drop Rosie. And I wish this concept were dropped. Now, again, in the movie, this concept is dropped, and it's much smarter, because the idea is if May is saying, here's Gloria Rasputin, get involved with her, what she's essentially saying is, I don't want you to marry that Spanish woman. While indeed, if there's no Gloria Rasputin, then the issue is, I don't want you to get married because I want you all for myself. And mm-hmm. that's a very different issue in that type of possessiveness. So I'm sorry that Gloria Rasputin wasn't dropped. And of course, you would save a salary as well. But though, of course, she came from the ensemble, and that was that. The cast is fine. Nobody's great. Everybody's fine. I do think that if I were doing this show, I would certainly get more of an Elvis impersonator for Conrad Birdie, even though Strauss-Dan and Fully admit the name comes from Conway Twitty, who was a star at the time. But it really is Elvis Presley, of course, who was going into the Army during that period of time. But, you know, the song from the 1995 movie, A Mother Doesn't Matter Anymore, is given to Christine Zbornik. And, you know, one of the sad things, I saw the Road Company of Bye Bye Birdie way back when, and Kay Medford was still in it, and she was so hilarious and so wonderful. And you may get a sense of that from her performance in the Funny Girl movie. But, yeah, it was sad that she never had a song. You know, she's not in the original cast album at all, no more than Michael J. Pollard, who played Hugo, was on the original cast album at all. So Christine Zbornik had this number, and it tore the house down. That got the biggest response of the night of any of the songs. So credit where it's due. The young woman playing Kim, I'm sorry to say, like Anne Margaret, is too old. However, she's not nonstop sexy seductress as Anne Margaret was in the film. I'm not complaining about Anne Margaret in the film. Believe me, as a teenager, I literally went 10 times in 2 months. And it really was mostly for that beginning and ending sequence. So the next time you see me on the street, ask me to do every move in that opening and closing sequence, and I'll do it for you. So,
like Brian Bat on Mad Men.
Yes, indeed. The thing is that while she tries to play innocent, she's successful at it. I mean, she simply just looks too old. And it's too bad they didn't get a real teenager in there to do it, because I think that would be far more effective. Still, this is a solid revival, and anybody who's enjoyed Bye Bye Birdie, I recommend this heartily, because it's fun to see the changes. It's, for example, another one I'll bring up is that I've always thought it was ridiculous that both in the stage play and the movie, where after Kim sings One Boy to Hugo, that both Cheetah Rivera and Janet Leigh sing One Boy about Al. But he's not a boy. Well, he is a man-child, but that's not the issue of the song. So here it's one guy, and I think that's far more successful. So I like that very much. And so little tweaks here and there. You know, I don't think anything has been done that really injures the property. Starting with the Telephone Hour, after all, is in the great Broadway tradition of starting a musical with a big number. But to me, it's a lateral change. It neither improves nor detracts from what the show was. But it's a fun revival, and certainly just as the in 1963, when that movie was released, it was released right around the same time of the year because it was supposed to be a summer movie. So if we have summer movies, we can certainly have summer musicals, and this Bye Bye production certainly fills that need.
All right. Next up, Two by Tennessee, and why don't you take us through that, and what did you think about it?
Well, Two by Tennessee involves 27 wagons full of cotton, his one-act play, which was later expanded into the movie Baby Doll, and very controversially, that was a hot picture at the time, I mean, like condemned by the Legion of Decency and all that. And the other play, which is a longer one-act, is Kingdom of Earth, which was originally a play he wrote in the 1967-68 season. It was then called The Seven Descents of Myrtle. When it was made to a movie, it had its name changed too, just as 27 Wagons Full became Baby Doll. This became the last of the Mobile Hotshots. Now it's Kingdom of Earth because it's rewritten and condensed. I'll tell you, that last of the Mobile Hotshots is a wild and woolly picture. And this is a wild and woolly one-act play as well. Seeing 27 Wagons Full of Cotton reminded me of when I was still living in Boston and came to New York in 1976, when I stayed with my friend Richard Dorton. He said, "So what are you seeing?" I said, "Well, a very good Eddie and Rockabye Hamlet, and I may go back to Chicago, A Chorus Line, if I can get in." And he said, "Please, I beg of you, go see 27 Wagons Full of Cotton. I said, really? Why? He said, because there's this actress, I'm telling you, her name is Meryl Streep, and you are going to hear about this lady, I guarantee it. This is a star. And he convinced me, and I went, and I certainly saw what he saw. And, of course, the world has seen that since. Now, I can't say, of course, that Catherine Lou Scarfunkel is Meryl Streep, but she does give a very convincing performance as a woman who has been treated as a baby doll by her husband. And the problem is, when you're treated by a baby doll, you can't grow. And she winds up indicting him for a crime because she's too naive and has been kept barefoot, if not pregnant, but she is barefoot. And her mind is pretty bare as well. So that's what the conflict is there. You treat a woman like an idiot, and that's the level to which she'll reach. So that's the point of the first play. The second play, Kingdom of Earth, is Wild and Woolly, even though it's not as Wild and Woolly as the film version, because here comes in Myrtle, originally played by Estelle Parsons, who, by the way, had to take a night off during the run of the play to go to Hollywood because she was nominated for an Oscar for Bonnie and Clyde, which she did indeed win, and then came back to do the play. It didn't last much longer. But here, Judy Jerome is playing Myrtle, and she's a newlywed. 3 days earlier, she had not yet met her husband. She met him 2 days ago. They got married the next day, and here they are coming to his half-brother's not house, but where the half-brother lives. In fact, it's the newly married man who has title to the house because, again, half-brother. So when the father died, he left it to the other brother and not to him. But the half-brother, who, by the way, is called Chicken, really wants this house, and he is hoping that his brother will die so that he can take title of the house. Well, when the brother shows up, he's really sick. I mean, he is really sick. And Myrtle, of course, is expected to take care of her new husband, but she's very much attracted to Chicken. And, you know, when you think of a person who's been married like around 24, 25, 26 hours to somebody who she's known 47, 48, 49 hours, there isn't going to be much devotion there. And believe me, there isn't. Let me point out that Michael Keller, who plays the condescending husband in the first play and plays Chicken, the half-brother, in the second play, gives a phenomenal performance. So while I can't say I came away thinking that Catherine Lou Scarfunkel will be the next Meryl Streep, I do think we can look for a pretty good career from Michael Keller. So he's really worth seeing. So Tennessee Williams fans should get over there, especially if they know the movie of Last of the Mobile Hotshots or Baby Doll, because to see the changes are pretty fascinating. I mentioned 1967-68 because that's the season that William Goldman certainly annotated wonderfully in his book The Season. And he gives a speech that he gives as convincing evidence that The Seven Descents of Myrtle was a worthy play. And that speech is still intact in Kingdom of Earth. And it still is a very good speech. I'm not going to tell you what it's about because I'm hoping to get you to see Kingdom of Earth.
That kind of wraps up our reviews for today. But Michael is going to tell us about Barbara Cook's new book. So, Michael, tell us about that.
Yes, she wrote a wonderful memoir called Then and Now. Then and Now, with Tom Santopietro, but it really sounds like her voice throughout. I've interviewed her on several occasions, and she's always been a great interview. I think that everyone will enjoy this book. It's got a quote from Frank Langella: "Her talent has always been unique and her artistry superb, but this book is more a testament to Barbara's courage, strength, and determination to endure. The power of her inner voice, it turns out, matches the great gift of her outer one. How lucky we are now to have seen and heard both." And it's from Harper is the publisher, and it's been out for, I think, a few weeks now. There is not Well, there are some revelations. The main one, I think, is that she had at one point an affair while she was still married to Arthur Hill, of all people, the original George in the original Broadway production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and who later wider audiences may know from the TV series Owen Marshall, Counselor at Law. I never had heard that. Barbara Cook has told many stories in her one-woman shows and in interviews, but I think this is the first time she ever mentioned that, and it's interesting to hear about her perspective on that. Also, it seems her early years were really quite unhappy, problems with her mother, etc., and it's always interesting to find out where people came from and what they had to deal with in their lives. The things she writes about the individual shows are not terribly exhausting in terms of analysis of the show or like day-to-day chronicles of the rehearsals or anything like that. But she does, of course, write about that. And she focuses, I think, more on her own personal experience of the shows. She spends a lot of time on how much she loved Robert Preston and what a really wonderful man he was, aside from being such a great star. So that was great. She does refute again, as she has done to me on more than one occasion, any suggestion that Frank Lesser wrote any part of the score of The Music Man. So as far as Barbara Cook is concerned, no. And I think I would say she's probably just about as good a source as we can get, at this point anymore. So I think we will have to stick with that. One interesting thing is that at some point the book becomes a book about Elaine Stritch, who Barbara worked with on a few occasions, including the famous concert production of Follies at the New York Philharmonic years ago that kind of brought Follies back into the consciousness and was originally planned, I believe, to I believe it was planned just as a recording. And then they realized that they had all these stars involved, Lee Remick and George Hearn and Mandy Patinkin and Comden and Green and Carol Burnett and blah, blah, blah. And then somebody said, well, why don't we do it as a concert and sell tickets? So that's what happened. And Barbara Cook was Sally and Elaine Stritch, although I think for a while they weren't sure what role she was going to do, but she wound up doing the Broadway Baby song. Barbara Cook recounts several stories of how incredibly talented Elaine was, but she could be so, so, so difficult in terms of her behavior and the way she related to people. And she even mentions specifically that really annoying moment in the documentary about Follies where it's a rehearsal room, I believe, at Avery Fisher Hall. And Barbara Cook is singing with piano in Buddy's Eyes, that incredibly beautiful song. And every single person there, Lee Remick, et cetera, is just rapt listening to this beautiful rendition of this gorgeous song. And there's a big shot in the middle of it. Elaine Stritch is sitting among the people there, and she starts to go through her bag. rummage. I think she changes her shoes at one point. She just was frankly, like, really appalling in the way she would always take focus, and it always had to be about her. But on the other hand, it's a huge testament to her talent that she was so talented that people would put up with that. And I think if she were even slightly less talented, people would have turned their back on her. So that really says something for her. And it's also interesting that Barbara Cook kind of allows Elaine to hijack her own memoir. For several pages, it becomes a book about Elaine Stritch. But that that in itself is very telling and extremely entertaining, as you might imagine. But there are, you know, the bulk of the book, of course, is not about Elaine Stritch. It's about Barbara Cook, who has had an amazing career and continues to this day to perform. She had she just had a one-nighter at Feinstein's 54 Below, and has two more coming up. This was in lieu of – there had been talk of her doing a – well, not talk. It had been announced that she was going to do a one-woman off-Broadway show at New World Stages, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that didn't happen. But instead, she is at 54 Below. So God bless Barbara Cook, and the book is well worth your while.
All right. So we'll have to take a look at that. It got a pretty good review in the New York Times as well. So I'll link to that that review of the book.
She writes very, very well. I mean, just because someone is obviously a great actress doesn't mean they can write, but it really sounds like her talking, and it's it really, really does sound like her voice. So that it's very successful on that level as well.
Yeah, I can. I haven't read the book. From what you can describe, it certainly seems like that would have been quite the show, you know, if she was able to do that. So we'll see what happens. Before we started recording, we talked about that coming up is the next 7 days that you're going to have an opportunity to see Shuffle Along as it closes next Sunday, the 24th of July. And as I've said before, I'm very sad about that because I love Shuffle Along, and I think that it's getting a lot of love on social media. Lots of people have visited it in the last couple of weeks and are reading wonderful things about it, and nobody can understand why it's closing, and that it's just it's sad that they're not able to sell more tickets. So if you are listening to this broadcast in the next 7 days and you have the opportunity to get to New York and get a ticket and get into that theater, I encourage you to do that. So if that's it, do you guys have anything else? If not, I will get on to the trivia portion.
I think that's it.
Uh-huh. All right. Okay, so before we get to trivia, and it's going to be a special trivia, so don't tune out just yet. I want to remind everybody that I just got a new tongue, and you can listen to us by subscribing on iTunes by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is a Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your Android device. Or Broadway World plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer for last week's trivia?
Yeah, the question was, what star, and that's the important word, what star appeared in original productions of musicals by Bob Merrill, Meredith Willson, Strauss and Adams, Conan Van Heusen, even Stephen Sondheim? And I have to say that Jake Leonard got this within 10 seconds of it being given out. I was really so impressed that he got it so quickly. And then Jake Leonard is our listener from Australia, and Harriet Parmenter got it too. So I guess this question was answered by Aussie and Harriet. So it's I'm teasing. There was no Harriet Parmenter. I just felt like saying that. No, Jake Lennon was the only one who got it. And I will admit that it drove a lot of people crazy because it was a terribly unfair trick question, because the star I'm talking about is Bill Starr with two R's, who appeared in Take Me Along, Bob Merrill, The Unsinkable Molly Brown, Meredith Willson, All American and Superman, Strauss and Adams, a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum. He was in that as well. So you know, it was a trick question. It was a little on the mean side. So this week, Michael, I'm sure, will be nicer when he gives a trivia question, which is, Michael, what?
I hope this isn't too easy. In the 1970s, there was a musical in which the leading lady sang a song with lyrics that contained the title of another show that she would star in some years later, and also contained the name of another actress who has also done musicals and plays on Broadway. So please name all of those things. Name the star of the 70s musical, the name of the title of the musical that she would go on to star in a few years later, and the show in which she sang the song, and the other Broadway leading lady.
I am going to say I'm an equal opportunity failure that I can't get either Michael's nor Peter's trivia ever. So we'll leave it up to the listeners. If you know the answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com, and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
You will not know a day I do not love you the way that I have loved you all along. And if we ever were to one fact alone is full and filled with sorrow.